The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
I just finished reading Eugenia Ginsburg's memoir, Journey into the Whirlwind, which is about her 18-year sojourn in the wilderness of Stalin's gulags. The knock on the door that prefaced her arrest in Moscow is not something we imagine happening in Portland, Oregon, or Los Angeles, or another American city, but it did happen to one of our speaker Stephen T. Wax's clients, Brandon Mayfield, a nightmare that began for him on May 7th, 2004, when agents from the FBI came to his law office and arrested him. And you'll be hearing more about that tonight. The format for tonight is a conversation between Stephen T. Wax and Lori Levinson. Ian Masters could not be here with us tonight, and we are very fortunate to have Lori Levinson here to be in conversation with Stephen. Tonight we'll hear about Brandon Mayfield, and we'll hear about Stephen T. Wax's other clients held as enemy combatants in Guantanamo, Cuba. Are all the men held in Guantanamo, as our elected leaders told us, the worst of the worst? Are they all hardened criminals? After tonight, that premise will surely be in question. The New Yorker magazine just lauded Wax's book, Kafka Comes to America, Fighting for Justice in the War on Terror, as an enthralling, enraging narrative that illustrates the short path from depriving terrorists of their rights to depriving everyone else. Wax captures the damage that Guantanamo has done to America's reputation abroad and shows how the legal fights on behalf of detainees might restore it. Stephen T. Wax is in his seventh term as the federal public defender for the District of Oregon. He was a key part of the Brooklyn, New York District Attorney's prosecution of David Berkowitz, also known as Son of Sam. As I mentioned, he and his team are representing seven men held as enemy combatants at Guantanamo. He's taught at the Northwestern School of Law of Lewis and Clark College, serves as an ethics prosecutor for the Oregon State Bar, and lectures throughout the country. We are extremely fortunate, as I said, to have Lori L. Levinson tonight. Ms. Levinson is professor of law, William M. Raines Fellow, and director of the Center for Ethical Advocacy at Loyola Law School. She teaches ethics, criminal law, criminal procedure, trial advocacy, and evidence. Prior to joining the Loyola Law faculty in 1989, Professor Levinson served for 8 years as an assistant U.S. attorney in Los Angeles. In 1988, she received the Attorney General's Director's Award for Superior Performance. You've probably seen her on several news shows. She's often consulted. So without further ado, we will open for questions after the conversation. We ask that you wait until the microphone comes to you because we do record for podcast. And now please welcome Stephen T. Wax and Lori Levinson to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure and an honor to be here with our author today. And his book, which I have not only read cover to cover but highlighted as well, is what I would call a must read. It's certainly a must read for my law students because I've assigned it to all of them. And I would suggest maybe after we hear from the author, you'll see it as a must read for everyone as well. As was introduced, this is a book that's an insight into things that most Americans didn't know about until Mr. Wax wrote about them. And it's an insight into what's happening on our own soil with people who are accused in the war on terrorism, as well as those that we're holding in Guantanamo Bay. Even for those of us who have tried to keep up with the so-called war on terrorism, there are so many eye-opening experiences. So I'd like to ask you, Stephen, to just sort of start out by telling us about your clients, about the real people that make this such an important book.
Okay, that's a great place to start, Lori. Brandon Mayfield. Brandon was born in Oregon. He was raised as a Christian in Kansas, came back to Oregon later on for law school after having served in the United States Army. He married an Egyptian woman whose father was a professor at a university in the great state of Washington, has three kids, and in 2004, at the time of this arrest, he had just set up a small private law practice focusing primarily on domestic relations and immigration matters. Adel Hamad, the other person about whom I write in the book, born in Sudan. His father was a medical person, not an actual doctor, but was the only person in the part of Sudan they lived in who provided medical care. As a kid, Adel would go around with his dad on his rounds, sometimes literally, you know, on donkey back. He went to university in Egypt. He got a degree in engineering, came back to Sudan in the mid-1980s, wasn't able to get the type of job that he wanted, and was fortunate enough to get a job working with a charity that was providing aid to the refugees of what were then the Afghan-Soviet wars. Got married in 1986. He and his wife had ultimately five daughters. While they were in Sudan, they had four daughters. He worked for 17 years for two different charities, living in Pakistan, working in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And in 2000, he was able to get a job as a hospital administrator, a regular guy.
Well, these sound like good guys, regular guys. That's certainly not how the government saw them, and that's what you write about. So what was the government accusing each of them of, and how does this end up with the Federal Public Defender's Office?
Well, two different questions. Brandon was arrested on a material witness warrant on May 6, 2004. Some of you may recall that in March of 2004, bombs exploded at seven train stations in Madrid, Spain. 191 people were killed, more than 2,000 people were injured, and among the people who were killed were three Americans. The Spanish were fortunate enough to find a bag of unexploded detonators at one of the train stations and were able to lift some latent fingerprints from that bag. They didn't find a match initially and sent those latent prints out through the electronic media to law enforcement agencies around the world, including our own FBI. And within a week, our FBI said that they had declared and found a match. And when the court documents were filed and revealed to us, we saw that the FBI said that three senior examiners, each with more than 30 years' experience, had declared a 100% match. Now, I don't know if you recall, Lori, from your days practicing.
I didn't know you could have a 100%
well,
match.
Well, neither did I. You know, in my 36 years as prosecutor and defense attorney, I have never seen any expert say anything like that. But that's what the FBI said. As it turned out, they were 100% wrong.
Yeah, how could it go so wrong? I actually, before you answer that, what was your client's reaction? Imagine, you know, you're a lawyer working in town, you've got kids, you're putting together your practice, and all of a sudden, how did he find out that he was the target or the defendant in this major investigation?
The dreaded knock on the door. May 6th. 9:30 in the morning, Brandon was in his law office, which was in a little strip mall just outside of Portland. Knock on the door. Two FBI agents standing outside his door. "Now, Mr. Mayfield, we'd like to talk with you." "What about?" "Well, Mr. Mayfield, we'd like to talk with you. Can we come in?" "No, you can't. I have client files in here." "Well, Mr. Mayfield, we have a warrant for your arrest." That's how we found out.
And how did his family find out what was going on here? Because he has young children, he's got his wife. What's going on with them?
Well, at the same time that the agents were at Brandon's law office, armed with the arrest warrant and also a search warrant for the law office, another team of agents was at his house, armed with a search warrant, and a search was conducted of his house there. And it was through that process that his wife, Mona, became aware that something was happening.
Now, I take it that wasn't the first time that the government was in his house. We've heard a little bit about sneak and peek warrants or sneak and peek searches. What happened in this situation?
Within a few days of the FBI declaring its 100% match in March, they went to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court.
Like maybe you want to explain what that is a little bit.
Okay. 1978, under the Carter administration, Republicans and Democrats crafted a compromise to authorize the government to obtain warrants for electronic surveillance.
So it's like a secret court.
A secret court. Well, it is. When I attempted to file a pleading with it during my representation of Brandon, I actually called the court. Finally, after quite a struggle, got a phone number, and the clerk said, "Oh, Mr. Wax, you can't file pleadings here. Excuse me, this is an American court. I need to file pleadings. I need to know what is going on with my client." The answer, no one has ever done that.
Because
you can't.
Only the government gets to go to the secret court.
That's right.
And they went with a secret warrant and sort of snuck into your client's house and looked around. How
yes.
good are they at sort of staying sneaky?
Well, in this particular instance, they weren't so good. Early April, Mona Mayfield came home from work one day. She put the key in the lock at the front door. The door wouldn't open. Someone had thrown a deadbolt that the Mayfields never use. When she finally got in around a side entrance, she saw that all the digital clocks were flashing. Someone had monkeyed with the electricity. So in the home that night, Brandon and Mona are talking, you know, did you throw the lock? Did you? No. What's going on here? And they were concerned. Well, did something happen or not? Nothing was taken. A week later when she came home, there was a footprint in the carpet. A footprint in a deep pile carpet where she knew there couldn't be one because she had vacuumed. That created genuine terror in their home. I mean, the two of them started making plans. They contacted his family. You know, what do we do? Mom and Dad, if we disappear, if something happens to us, someone needs to take care of our kids.
That's terrifying. So we've got Brandon Mayfield, and we'll get to the other client as well, and he's being charged, as you said, as a material witness, which means it sounds like they want him to testify, but you say they have this fingerprint print. Don't they really think of him as the bomber or as a defendant?
There's no question that some of the people in the FBI and in the Department of Justice were convinced that he was ultimately going to be charged. What happened was that toward the end of April, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Oregon, talking with the FBI in Oregon, thought, you know, why don't we just knock on Brandon's door and ask him, what's going on, Brandon? They were not permitted to do that by the powers that be in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, so that gets my big question here. How can things go so wrong? I mean, you have FBI agents saying it's 100% match. It turns out, how far down the process did you find out it wasn't a match?
Well, you've asked a couple of questions there, Lori. A compound question. Let me break it down, okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
May 5, there's an email sent by one FBI office to another saying, we're afraid that Brandon is going to be outed. We don't have enough to arrest him and charge him. We'll arrest him on this material witness warrant and hold him until we can charge him. A misuse and abuse of the material witness statute. You can't do that. How did things go so bad? Why did that happen? How does the FBI make this mistake? I'm going to answer that not with my opinion. I'm going to answer it by reference to a team of international experts that was called together by the FBI, which was asking itself that question. And this team of international experts said, the mistake here was made entirely by operator error, mistake by the FBI agents. Why? How did that happen? Well, in part because they abandoned the scientific method. Instead of an agent looking at the print and saying, well, okay, looks like maybe this is a match, and then having another agent do a blind study separately, the first agent says, hey, Joe, come over here, look over my shoulder. Confirmation. Hey, what do you think? Oh, yeah, sure. You know, Harry, it doesn't look like you made a mistake. You've been around 30 years. Okay. The other thing they said, I think, is applicable not only to the fingerprint issue, but to any number of other problems that have arisen in this war on terror. And that is, this international panel said, again, this isn't the defense speaking. This is the FBI speaking through its international panel. Big case pressures. What does that mean?
We think about it, the phrase rush to judgment here in Los Angeles. Does that come to mind?
Well, I think that rush to judgment assumes that actual judgment is being exercised, which may be a step ahead of what was happening here. Big case pressures. You know, we need to keep in mind that our government does have a weighty responsibility to try to keep us safe and to solve terrorist acts. But what happens, according to this panel of experts convened by the FBI, is that it can cause such desire to solve the case. The stress of doing something causes you to lose perspective, causes the agents, causes the president, the vice president, who knows, to act as if they have blinders on. They see only what they expect or want to see.
So they see this little defense lawyer in Portland, Oregon, behind this international Madrid bombing scheme? I mean, that seems just amazing. In fact, one of the lines in the book, not to give it all away, is, you know, when you're trying to talk to your client about this, and he had the reaction that I think many of us might have. He says, but I'm a United States citizen. I mean, where does that presumption of innocence factor into this, or just the way we're used to seeing the criminal justice system?
Well, it does not factor in, unfortunately, in too many of the things that are happening in the war on terror. One of the things that has been said about the decisions that the Bush administration has taken has been put out by Ron Susskind as the 1% doctrine. If there's a 1% chance that somebody might do something bad, we're going to act. So the presumption of innocence is turned on its head. And that's what I was talking about a few moments ago in terms of the pressures that our leaders do have to try to keep us safe, causing a different way of looking at these issues and along the way sacrificing innocent people like Brandon and Adele and their wives and their children and who knows how many countless others as well. That's a cost of this changed way of doing business.
And we hear a lot about racial profiling, but it strikes me that it wasn't coincidence that the one person they pick out is Brandon Mayfield because of?
Well, we don't need to speculate again. We just need to read the affidavit that the government submitted in support of the search and arrest warrants. Because in the affidavit, they said, first and foremost, we have probable cause, we have reasonable suspicion because of the fingerprint identification. But the next paragraph says, Brandon Mayfield's a Muslim. Brandon Mayfield's been seen attending a mosque. Brandon Mayfield is married to a woman of Egyptian descent. Brandon Mayfield is a lawyer, and he represents...
That's very dangerous. Yeah.
And he represented a man in Portland who had been convicted of terrorism. And perhaps most chilling to any of the other lawyers in the audience, they then said in full gory detail the anti-American and anti-Semitic views of Brandon's client. So that's what's put into the affidavit.
Called poison.
Well, Brandon used the word profiling.
Question. How serious of offenses was Brandon facing? I mean, this was a death penalty case, I take it.
Yes. U.S. law authorizes prosecution in this country of people who kill American citizens overseas. So in the documents that we were provided on Brandon's first appearance in the court, it said he was wanted in connection with capital offenses. And in our discussions with the government during our representation, they said, we want to talk to Brandon. We said, well, give him immunity. No, we can't do that. Okay, at least take the possibility of a capital prosecution off the table. And the answer was no.
Well, it sounds like in these circumstances, only the most brilliant lawyer could be able to save him.
Well, Laurie...
And without giving away everything in the book, was it luck? Was it hard work? How do you sort of, when you're facing these kind of odds, how do you take this on?
One says, gracias a los Espanos. The Spanish didn't give up. The Spanish continued their investigation, and the Spanish told the FBI 3 weeks before Brandon was arrested, it's not his print. And there is a letter, for anyone who buys the book, you can see a copy of it in the book, where the Spanish bolded the word negative in the letter. Dear FBI, this is not Brandon's print. Our conclusion is negative. Bold, capital letters, no mistake about it. Yeah.
It's almost hard to believe. Well, there's more to this story because you have another client, and that's Adele. And he's sitting down in Guantanamo. Maybe you can give people an idea of, wow, how did he get to Guantanamo? He's originally from Sudan. Mm-hmm. He's working where in Pakistan. How does he end up in Guantanamo?
I don't know that we will ever know the answer to that question, Laurie. We know a few things. We know that in 2002, one of Adele's responsibilities had to do with the warehousing of food supplies that the charity was distributing in refugee camps. And pressure was brought to bear on him by some Pakistani authorities to use a different warehouse so they could siphon some of the food off. He refused. Something else, which is probably more significant, is that in 2002, our government was saying to President Musharraf of Pakistan, you're either with us or against us in this war on terror. Musharraf, you know, ante up. Show us your bona fides. Show us you're fighting the war. So, Musharraf says to the Pakistani security police, we need to give the Americans some bad guys. We can't find Osama, or maybe we don't want to find Osama, so we need to give them some bad guys. Now, the Pakistani security police are in large part comprised of men of Pashtun origination.
Okay, so for those of us who are not experts in Pashtun or, you know, origination,
yes.
What difference does that make?
The Taliban are primarily Pashtun. In Afghanistan and Pakistan, there are a number of tribal groups. The Pashtuns are one of the larger groups, and many of the Taliban were and are Pashtun. So the Pashtun Taliban sympathizers in the Pakistani security police, and anyone following the current affairs knows that the Taliban are now not only resurgent in Afghanistan, but have also taken over large stretches of eastern Pakistan. So, what do you do if you are getting pressure from your president? We got to give the Americans some bad guys. Let's round up the usual suspects. Who are the usual suspects in Pakistan? The other. We all define someone as the other. Well, the Arabs living in Pakistan were the other to the Pakistanis.
So a little racial profiling going on there.
Yes. And we know that in the spring of 2002, there were many Arabs who were rounded up, arrested, and given to the Americans.
Well,
my client among them.
Your client's sitting rather incommunicado down in Guantanamo Bay. How does he become your client?
Great question. Okay, let me make this a short answer, as short as I can. As soon as the first men got there in 2002, lawyers were contacted by the families of some of the British people who were in Guantanamo. They filed habeas corpus petitions, petitions saying that the president does not have the power on his own say-so alone to seize and imprison people. The judiciary gets to determine the legality of the actions. So over the course of the next 2 years, the Bush administration says, judges, you have no power. Habeas is not available. I, the president, am asserting a power that was stripped from English kings in the 1600s, but asserted in our country in court papers over the last 6 years. 2004, the Supreme Court says for the first of three times to the administration, and the first of two times to the administration in Congress, you don't have that power. As a result, notices were given to all the men in Guantanamo. Hey guys, you want to join the party? You can file habeas petitions in Washington. Here's the address. 50 guys filed petitions. Those petitions get to the court in Washington. The court very smartly says, well, we can't handle these without lawyers involved. Turn to the Center for Constitutional Rights and the pro bono lawyers who had been representing the first wave of men and says, help. Those lawyers say, we're full up. Turn to my counterpart, the federal defender in Washington, D.C., A.J. Kramer. Hey, A.J., we got a deal for you, 50 new clients. A.J. says, I'll take three. I don't want to ruin my office. The decision was then made to put out a call to federal defenders around the country. Could any of us help? I volunteered my office. It seemed to me that the issues presented in these cases are the most fundamental issues of my legal lifetime.
But you are on totally uncharted waters here. I mean, I've been teaching criminal law for a long time. I've never before had to say, what do you do when you have a client you've never met, you don't know anything about the facts, and the government won't tell you anything? How do you even start on helping that client?
You make it up as you go along, Lori.
Well, so did the government.
Well,
yeah.
You know, it was a terribly difficult situation. I mean, fortunately, we had some model pleadings to borrow from that CCR and some of the pro bono lawyers had used. So without meeting any of our clients, we put together petitions based on the one paragraph that some of our clients had submitted. With some of the clients, including Adel, I didn't even know what country he was from or what language he spoke the first time I got on a plane to go meet him in Guantanamo.
But let's talk about meeting your client. What was that like? And what's he like as a person?
The first time you go down to this island, tropical paradise. Oh, no, it's not. It's Cuba. It's a communist police state. No, it's not. You're in Guantanamo. It's a U.S. naval base. Okay. No, you're not in a naval base. You're going to a prison. You're going to a prison in paradise where Secretary of State Rumsfeld said they were holding the worst of the worst, where President Bush said everyone was picked up on a battlefield, where Vice President Cheney said that these men would, you know, just as soon do nasty things to their mothers as spit on the ground. And you go through an FBI full field clearance. You get a security clearance before you can go there. You have to get a military theater clearance before you can set foot on the base. And you walk in through more and more checks with a guard into the inner courtyard of Camp Echo on a concrete path, led up to a door in a roughly 20 by 40 wooden structure, two numbers on it. That first day, numbers 11 and 12. Up to door number 12. The guard opened the door, and I looked in. There was a little formica table, you know, just somewhat larger than the one that's sitting in front of us on this stage, a chair, folding chair behind it. Sitting in the chair, a very dark-skinned man, which surprised me because my view of Arabs, and perhaps this is my inherent racism, was that I would be meeting a light-skinned person. Literally chained to the floor. That's the first image I have of my client. Chained to the floor like a dog.
Now, what was your client's reaction to you? Was he suspicious?
Yes.
How did you establish a relationship? I mean, what did you talk about at the beginning? Did you launch into, gee, are you a terrorist or what?
We started by talking about ourselves. You know, as a government employee, we have a somewhat greater hurdle to overcome in Guantanamo than do some of the lawyers working for some of the civil firms. So we just started talking to him. You know, hey, Adel, you know, I'm Steve Wax from Portland, Oregon, you know, federal defender. You know, this is my life. This is what I do. Volunteered to, you know, to be down here. Asked the court to assign us because I believe this is important. We probably talked to him or at him, you know, through an Arabic-speaking interpreter for, you know, 15 or 20 minutes. And then, you know, he asks a little question or two, and then we start asking him some questions. And the first thing we ask him is, how are you? Because one of the things that we knew from the lawyers who had been there before us was that many of the men in Guantanamo are suffering from very severe psychiatric problems. And the reality is, the unfortunate reality is, that several of the clients of my office, one of whom I've spent a fair amount of time with, is in very bad shape. Multiple suicide attempts.
And had he been subject to interrogation, was he willing to talk about that?
Yes. I mean, we over the course of the first 2 days and then the other five times or four times that I was there, a total of five, and other visits by other staff members, you know, we talked about everything. We talked about the interrogations. We talked about his charity work. We talked about his family. And in the midst of this, just absolutely surreal experience, maybe the third visit, maybe the fourth visit, he told me that he'd had a son. You know, we've gone along, he's talked about his daughters, and you know, we've shared some stuff about family, and he had a son who died, which struck a real chord with me because I'd had a son who died. And you get these, you know, emotional bonding experiences sometimes with clients where you go to a very deep human level. And one of the things about working with Adil, as opposed to some of the other clients in Guantanamo and the other clients I work with generally in bank robbery and drug and other cases, is he is a remarkable and remarkably strong human being. He still believes in American justice. We kept him in prison for 5 years, 4 months, and 25 days. And when I've talked with him now that he's home, he says to me, "Steve, I want justice. I still think you can get me justice from the American system." And on the one hand, it makes me so proud to be an American that there is still such belief in our system. And on the other hand, it makes me want to cry.
And you describe, and it is an amazing book because you open up so much of your life as well as that of your clients. But there's a passage in here where you're describing trying to say goodbye to him. And he doesn't know if he's going to see you again. And I take it you don't know what's going to happen next either. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
At the end of the first visit, yeah, we started slowly. We developed some rapport. We brought food in. I mean, I can never bring food into an American prison. And you know, we have to go through all of this rigmarole to get into the prison in Guantanamo. Our papers are searched. Every individual paper is reviewed. If anything smacks of current events, we can't bring it into the client. But we can bring in food. I could even bring in a big metal thermos, I mean, which is just totally bizarre. I can't bring in a plastic spoon from McDonald's, but I can bring in a big thermos. Okay, guys, military, you have rules, we'll follow them. So in this first visit, we talk, we establish some rapport, and he sees a ray of hope. I mean, it is an island of despair, and I don't think I'm being melodramatic to describe it that way. We get to the end. We've been together in this remarkably intense two-day session. Pat Ehler's assistant defender, our interpreter, and me with Adil. Pat says goodbye. They shake hands. I shake hands with Adil. We start to pick up our papers, and he reaches out and he takes my hand again. And he holds it. He's holding my right hand. And then he puts his left hand, and he's holding my hand with both of his hands. And then I take my left hand, and now our four hands are joined together. And he looks at me, and he says, "When will I go home?" Now, I have no answer. I mean, the room is as silent as this auditorium. And you know, the ray of hope that we were for him during that two-day period was going out with
now,
us.
You describe in detail all the efforts, both legally and otherwise, that you make on his behalf. There's a couple things, though, that I find particularly fascinating. One is having to go to Afghanistan or send a team there to do an investigation. So you're sending your lawyers to a war zone. What's that like to investigate the situation?
Well, you know, all credit to the men who went there. And in this instance, it was only men. We have on the team men and women. We've had a number of the female lawyers and investigators go to Guantanamo. But that first team, because of the dynamics of gender issues in Afghanistan and Pakistan, it was all men. And they literally, you know, put their lives on the line. We have a photograph of one of the lawyers sitting on a beautiful old Afghan rug as they were heading out of Afghanistan up over the Khyber Pass into Pakistan. You know, in the AK-47 that our, you know, their guard, you know, is sitting on the carpet next to Reuben. The day after they passed through a particular section of that road, there was an improvised explosive device that was, that blew up, some people who came by. I mean, this was real. It was serious.
And I take it even you were taping witnesses and the like,
yes.
And those tapes were getting stolen and there were backups. I mean, it just sort of
yeah.
the sabotage yeah. that was going on. But take me to his home. You ended up going to see his family.
Yes, I went on the trip to Sudan. I did not go to Afghanistan, but I did go to Sudan. And in Sudan, met with his wife Salwa and his four daughters. His brother-in-law, who had been taking care of his wife and daughters while Adil was in prison. The Sudanese culture, in the Muslim culture, is somewhat conservative, and it was not safe for Adil's wife and daughters to live on their own. Fortunately, Adil's sister married to a wonderful guy who took care of them. And I mean, the poignancy of it, we get to their home, it's in a poor section of Khartoum, a mud-walled compound, maybe it's 150 feet on a side, which Adil and his brother-in-law had bought together in the late 1990s, and their dream was eventually to build a house there. Two one-room mud structures, another mud structure that served as the kitchen, a 30-foot pit in the ground that was their toilet, and his wife had an extremely difficult time at first. We get there, and she doesn't want to see us. She wants to see her husband. And after a few minutes, and it was only a few minutes, I mean, she said, I couldn't understand the Arabic words, but I could sure understand the tone. When will Adil come home? And at that point, she is still identifying William Teasdale, the investigator who's there with me, and me. We're Americans. We're the bad guys. We're the guys who've locked him up. By the time we left Sudan 12 days later, she and the family and everyone we had met understood that the Bush administration is not the only face of this country. And
now, there are a lot of different both legal and I would say extra legal efforts that you went through to get him out.
Illegal, let's make
not
sure.
Extra legal.
Yes.
But he helped himself, he tried to help himself as well. And that's a part of the book. Maybe you want to read it as well. He actually wrote a letter to President Bush.
That was his wife, Lori.
Oh, his wife. Yeah, his wife.
His wife. We're frustrated. We're completely frustrated. I mean, you have to understand that for 6.5 years, still today, after three rebukes by the Supreme Court on the legal positions the Bush administration has taken, they continue to say no process for these men or minimal process. So no court hearing has been held on the merits of anybody's case in 6.5 years, all tied up in a procedural morass. We're frustrated. We have all this evidence of innocence that we've gathered. What do we do with it? Well, we put it on YouTube. Okay? What do you do?
It's the great court of justice.
That's right. Tell the world about this. We sent it to the military itself. I sent it to the Deputy Secretary of Defense, who's in charge of the Guantanamo stuff.
And you got his cell phone number, or is that
well,
another
that was that was another man. A wonderful email, auto. Never send auto replies on your email if there are phone numbers on it that you don't necessarily want people to get. But I got an email with a phone number, and I spoke with a person who turned out to be a very decent fellow whose name I cannot or should not disclose, but who actually moved the military system an inch. But as part of this frustration, we also said to Adil's wife, look, Salwa, I remember 2000, the election. President Bush said he was a compassionate conservative. Let's focus on the compassion of this man. Now, our interpreter, a great Arabic professor from Portland State University, said, you guys are nuts. he said, no conservative Muslim woman in Sudan is going to be able to write to the president of the free world. And she wrote a letter.
She wrote a heck of a letter.
She wrote a heck of a letter. Want me to read a paragraph?
A paragraph.
Mr. President, how tough life has been while my husband Adil is still detained and far away from me and from his daughters. It is true that we are alive, but without him, our life has no taste, no color, and no smell to it. What can you say to very young children who have no water and no trees, no means of living, and the person who can clothe them has been placed in a dark pit. Be merciful, sir, and peace be with you.
Well,
needless to say, there was no reply.
I want to open it up in a minute for people here to ask you questions, but I'm going to actually end with asking about you. How did this case affect you? And I guess what would be the biggest message you're trying to send in this book?
I tried my first case in a clinic in law school 36 years ago. I went to law school in part because I believed in the rule of law. I believed that law could and should be an instrument of social justice, and that it is the law that keeps us all free. Over the years, prosecutor, defending, I have perhaps been able to shape the law a little bit. You know, there are big issues that emerge in very small cases. And in some of the cases, we've had the Ninth Circuit, the New York Court of Appeals, when I was back in New York, and the U.S. Supreme Court, since I've been in Oregon, push the law, improve the quality of justice for immigrants, improve the quality of justice for all of us in terms of the freedom that we need to enjoy from abusive police. These cases, they crystallized it all. I never thought I was going to write a book. I'm not one of these people who, from the time he was in high school, thought, I'm going to write the great American novel or anything like that. I've enjoyed my life as a public defender. I've enjoyed the opportunity to speak out on occasion as a public or semi-public official. But these cases crystallized for me what I believe in about our country, crystallized for me the values that I have held dear. And this book just emerged from me. I didn't have a choice. After the second visit in Guantanamo, I took out ye olde lawyer's yellow pad on the airplane, and I started writing. 3 hours on that little bouncy needle-nose plane back from Guantanamo to Fort Lauderdale, I didn't stop. I didn't stop until I got off the big jet in Portland, Oregon. First, I was just going to write a little magazine article, couldn't sell that. Well, I'm a defense attorney. I don't know how to take no for an answer, so you can't sell a magazine article. Write a book. What message do I want to convey? I hope that what people get out of this is how critical it is for all of us to speak out, for all of us to exercise the First Amendment rights and obligations that we have. That this democracy is only as good as we individuals make it. And if we do not use our voices, we will lose the democracy that we have. I don't think it's too late. You know, I get asked by people, what can I do? I get told by people, oh, I've gotten my Irish passport, I've gotten my English passport, I have my Bulgarian passport, I'm getting out of here. And my answer is, I've got one passport. I'm an American, and I'm going to fight for this country and hopefully energize some other people to do it as well.
Thank you. Now, I know that Steve has inspired all of us, so let's see what questions you might have for him. And I know there's a microphone, so we'll start down here. And we need you to wait till the microphone comes because of the podcast.
Thank you. I think you're a true hero.
Is it on?
No. As a public official and a I guess technically a government official, has there been any reprisal over your work?
Not yet. No, so far in Oregon, which is, as those of you in California who look north longingly sometimes may know, a relatively progressive state. Within the courthouse, the judges there, all the public officials there have been very supportive. And so far, knock on wood, no blowback from Washington.
Over here. There's a gentleman and then a young lady behind him.
Could you please define the term war on terror? And could you also give us your best guess? Where do you see America heading?
War on terror. The war on terror is a phrase that has followed in the footsteps of many other wars. We had a war on poverty with Lyndon Johnson. We've had a war on drugs. I mean, maybe that was Richard Nixon. War on terror. I mean, terror is a noun, I think. I mean, how do you declare war on a noun? I think that the Bush administration uses that phrase. Well, the person in the audience said to terrorize us. That is a very good end to the sentence. It's not exactly what I would have said. But I think that it connotes a sense of terror. I mean, we're not...
Well, in the book, you talk about that constant balancing between security and our rights. That puts a big finger on that side of the scale, doesn't it, when you're doing that balancing?
Well, absolutely. And I think that there has been very intentional manipulation of we Americans through the media, through the use of fear. I mean, I wrote an article for the Oregon State Bar Bulletin in 2004 that I called Fear in a Time of Terror. And I think that fear is a motivating force in a very, very negative way.
Let me do one quick follow-up question, and I'll get the question here, which is, people kind of wonder, well, how much do we have to be afraid of? I asked you before we began, how many of those people sitting in Guantanamo Bay do you really feel meet the description as the enemy combatant, the great terror threat that our government has represented?
Well, I'll just start by referring to facts rather than give you an opinion. The fact is that the Bush administration in 6.5 years has brought charges against fewer than 20 people. There are some men in Guantanamo who have been charged with actual war crimes, not being held just as enemy combatants. That's fewer than 20. The best speculation among the lawyers who are working on these cases is that at some point, maybe 50 people could be charged out of the 250 who are left. Yes, there are bad guys in Guantanamo. Yes, there are undoubtedly men in Guantanamo who most of the people in this room would want to see prosecuted, convicted, and imprisoned for a very long time. Part of the problem we now have is that the policies of the administration are going to make it exceedingly difficult to achieve that because you can't torture people, which they have done for years on end, extract confessions from them, which may well be false, and also try to use other products of torture. They have totally messed up the ability to prosecute some people who should probably be prosecuted and imprisoned.
Let me get another question, ma'am.
How thoroughly did you check into the fundraising work of your client, Otto, when he was doing that?
He was actually not engaged in fundraising. I mean, he was working as a food deliverer. He was working as a teacher. He was working as a hospital administrator. He did not engage personally in fundraising.
Was it the lawyer that did it? I guess I didn't get the facts right.
Was there anybody who was engaging in Muslim fundraising is the question.
That's what I thought I heard.
Well, the charities for whom he worked, of course, raised money. And the government alleges that some of the members of the charities for whom he worked, one of which has more than 2,000 employees in more than 50 countries, some of those people have taken anti-American positions. They never even said that Otto took an anti-American position.
But did you check into that personally? That's what I wanted, my question was.
I guess let's wrap up the question with that, which is, do you have any concerns? I mean, was that what you were looking at, or were you looking at what Otto's role was? I mean, there sounds like there's a lot of guilt by association that can go on here.
Yes, there is a tremendous amount of guilt by association, and we investigated everything that we could about his work history, his views, what he did. We also did research the two charities for whom he worked. And there is no question that our government believes that some people in those charities have funneled money to terrorists, and whether or not there is actual proof of that, I don't know. But there is no suggestion anywhere that my client ever did anything of that nature.
Thank you. Sir?
Thanks. I wonder if you're not riding two horses in different directions when you suggest that there was a failure of scientific methodology by the FBI with regard to Brandon Mayfield. When Laurie asked you whether there weren't, in fact, people in the FBI that believed that there was a 100% match on the print, you answered, well, there were people in the FBI who were convinced that he would be charged. Now, in fact, as you pointed out, the Spaniards had told the FBI that it wasn't his print, and they knew full well it wasn't. So I ask you whether this wasn't simply a frame-up of your client, deliberately, cynically, knowingly, for political purposes, by the FBI.
The only answer that I can give you is I did not sit in the FBI offices in either Portland or Washington and cannot give you a firsthand response to that. What I can tell you as a matter of fact is that when the Spanish letter arrived in the U.S., the FBI was concerned. They sent a team of agents to Spain to meet with the Spanish forensic police. At the conclusion of that meeting, the FBI wrote a report and said, the Spanish now agree with us. Now, I personally spoke with the head of the Spanish forensic police, and the head of the Spanish forensic police told me personally that that is not what occurred. Now, is it possible that the FBI engaged in a deliberate frame-up? Yes, that's possible. I have no evidence to support that. I have no evidence to support it.
All right. Everyone's going to draw their own conclusions. More questions up front here, please.
I don't know if I missed. How did you get to those two gentlemen? How did they come to you? How did you find them?
How did Brandon become a client? I think you mentioned that Udall had been through the references of the through Washington, D.C.
Yes.
But how about Brandon?
Brandon, when Brandon was arrested, he made his first appearance in the federal court in Portland with a friend of his, an attorney, a fellow Muslim, who was a civil lawyer. That lawyer knew that this was not his area of expertise, and when the court proceeding was done, he talked to the judge, and they then called my office and said, this is going to be a very expensive case. Brandon does not have the assets required to retain private counsel. Steve, can your office take it? And the court assigned us to represent him that afternoon.
And I understand that now you and Brandon still appear together on some cases. He's back in the practice of law, but this changed him, this experience.
It did change him. His life was turned upside down. And whether or not he will ever fully recover, only time will tell. But it was a devastating experience. He is putting his practice back together, but it's a long road. We stay in contact. We see each other. We were in court not as co-counsel, but we were in court together the other day, and he's said some nice things about the book in public.
That's a question here.
Just a threshold question. As an attorney, I wonder, what was the source of the fingerprint exemplar that the feds used and matched?
Interesting.
Brandon was in the U.S. military, and as a military person, his prints were in the national database. As an attorney, a member of the bar, his fingerprints are in the national database. It is not only people who are convicted of crimes who have their fingerprints fingerprints, in the database. Any profession that requires fingerprinting, any military person. I mean, the database at the time of this case, 2004, had more than 45 million prints in it. I'm confident today that it's well over 50 million.
That pretty much puts everyone at risk, and that level of detail is talked about in the book, amazingly. More questions here, ma'am.
Were any of your clients tortured? What was their experience? How did they share that? And what is the repercussion in their life now?
In Guantanamo, from January 11, 2002, when the first men were brought there, through August of 2003, there was torture. The torture in Guantanamo stopped in the summer of 2003 when the general who was in charge of the interrogation process in Guantanamo was transferred to Abu Ghraib in Iraq. And the reaction from the audience suggests that most people here are aware of the abuses that occurred there. The torture that Otto received occurred in the U.S. prison in Bagram, Afghanistan. Before he was taken to Guantanamo, he spent time in Bagram. And whether or not you call it torture, and you know, we can get into a debate, what is torture, what is not torture. I mean, I generally just say exceedingly harsh treatment. The treatment that he received there was so severe that he was hospitalized. After 2 weeks, our government had to hospitalize him. During that same time frame, January through March of 2003, two men in that same prison died as a result of the treatment they received at the hands of soldiers acting in our name.
And Steve, we focus on Guantanamo, but I take it those prisons are still open. We're still holding people there, and activities are still going on there.
Absolutely, Lori. I mean, one of the things that has not yet seeped into public consciousness in the way in which I think it should is the fact that right now, Guantanamo is really the
showcase.
Yeah. I mean, there are 250 men there. There are thousands, if not tens of thousands, of prisoners being held without trial, without charges, in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And many of those men, one could surmise, have also been rounded up for the wrong reasons, sold for bounties, which is literally what happened to some of the men in Guantanamo, sent there because of vendettas and mistakes, mistaken identity. One of our clients picked up in Afghanistan after he had lived from age 3 until age 20, whatever it was, in exile in Pakistan because he lost an eye to Russian bombs. When the military went into a house where he was staying, they, you know, what's your name? And he gives a name. Oh, that's on the list. Wrong guy. Wrong guy. He's now home after 4 years in prison.
More questions here. Let's take, you're near one right there, a couple there, and then one come over.
You know, when I listen to you, I can tell that there's an awful lot of anger and sort of outrage, but don't you understand with the rest of us, it's okay?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, basically what I'm trying to say is there's no real outrage in the United States at what's going on, and so you have to assume that for the rest of the American people, it's basically, it's okay.
Well,
you know?
Let me ask you, from the reaction to your book, do you think most people think it's okay, or they just don't really have learned as much about what's going on?
I think that there is a lack of knowledge. I mean, it was said centuries upon centuries ago that an educated populace is necessary to an effective democracy. And the dumbing down of our educational system, I think, is something that we pay a price for politically. I also think that there is fear, and fear of several types. It is extremely disturbing, I believe, for us to accept as a fact that our president, our vice president, our secretary of defense, and on down the line have lied to us. And they have lied to us. I had evidence in front of me when Attorney General Ashcroft testified under oath before a Senate committee about how this fingerprint mistake was made with Brandon. Now, I read about lies and speculation about lies and the aluminum tubes and what was Colin Powell sent out to say and what did he know or not do. But I had the evidence in this instance in front of me. I think that it is something that is very unsettling to us as a nation to have to accept the lawlessness at the top. That's frightening. You know, whether our roots are in Cambodia and, you know, we escaped Pol Pot, whether our roots are in Germany and we escaped Hitler, or in Russia and we escaped Stalin, or Spain and we escaped Franco. You know, it is not just third world countries, but it is the first world countries that have suffered at the hands of men, probably exclusively men in this instance, who have lied, cheated, stolen, and murdered in the names of their people. And while our government has only murdered on occasion, you know, the drone plane that, you know, fired into the car in Oman or Yemen, wherever that was, you know, I think that it's difficult for people to accept that. And I think that chills us. And I think that there is, in some instances, what we lawyers call a willful blindness.
And I think that this book, it becomes very liberating in that extent. A gentleman back here has been very patient. Thank you.
First of all, thank you very much for doing what you do, what you have been doing, and for writing about it. My question is about the interpreters in Guantanamo. Was there an issue of the interpreter and your client gaining rapport? You talk about the first two-hour meeting. How did he perceive the interpreter? Was he provided by the government, or was he a colleague of yours? And if you could just talk about that. Thank you.
Sure. The interpreters all have to have security clearances, and there is a dearth of Arabic and Pashto and Farsi-speaking people who can obtain security clearances who have not already been hired by the government to work for it. But we have some wonderful, wonderful men and women who have done interpreting work. Some of the interpreters are very, very clear that all they do is translate words from one language to another. And the interpreter I worked with the most, with Adel, is one of those. Adel would say something to him, and that interpreter would look at me and say, however he would call Adel, you know, the person has said to the interpreter, where are you from? He would not answer the question. Some of the interpreters took a more active and in some instances, one might say, less professional role, and in some instances were very helpful in establishing rapport. So it varied from interpreter to interpreter.
We have time for, I think, one or two last questions, right here and then right here.
I think in view of all the illegality of what many of us and what you're bringing to light in our country, and you as a lawyer, how do you see that we can redress this wrong that's happened in our country?
Speak out.
To whom and in what way could it actually have an effect on bringing people to justice or changing the policies or, you know, something that would be effective more than just my standing on the street corner?
All right.
After the Supreme Court issued its third rebuke to the Bush administration, both presidential candidates spoke out about the opinion. One spoke favorably about the majority opinion, saying, in essence, thank God that habeas corpus has been said to be alive and well and the president does not have a kingly power. The other presidential candidate said that he agreed with the dissent that the majority's view was an outrage. So there are politicians on both sides of the fence. We each have the right to vote. Exercise the right to vote. In addition, you have senators who probably have not heard often. You have representatives who probably have not heard often from the citizens of the great state of California that they want the people in Guantanamo to have justice. Let them know that that's how you feel. And whether you are a card-carrying member of the Heritage Society or the Cato Institute or the ACLU or Amnesty International, it seems to me this is an issue that transcends political and ideological lines. I mean, this is an issue in which I believe I am as conservative as any being can be. Because all I'm saying is, for God's sake, read the Constitution and let us carry out the ideals that we wrote into our law. So when you leave here tonight, go to your next Heritage Society meeting and say, hey guys, I heard this interesting talk. Heard about this interesting book. Why don't you read it? Let's get a petition and send something to Senator Feinstein. Or you go to your next ACLU meeting and say to your local ACLU chapter, hey guys, this is an issue on which we need to get energized. I mean, I don't know what more I can say.
We have one last question, this gentleman here, and then we're going to break for the book signing. And
well, the preceding question largely addressed it, but to follow up, do you feel also that the FISA law needs to be once again reviewed or revoked? Is that another issue we should be concentrating
on? Or is that another book you're going to write?
It is certainly another issue. Whether or not I can take the time to write another book, since I work my full-time job, this is on my time, not during my taxpayers' paid time. FISA is a huge issue. I was exceedingly disappointed in the vote that happened last week. And, when we look at what has happened in this war on terror, I think that we find enough blame, if it is blame, or enough praise, if we believe it's praise that's worthy, to go around across both parties. It was Congress that worked with the administration to pass the Detainee Treatment Act, the Military Commissions Act, and the amendments to FISA. Bush cannot do it alone.
FISA is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. All right. With that, I'm going to thank Steve Wax. I will applaud as well.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.